This Will Be Our Year Took a Long Time to Come by Hazel, read by Marianas. Mrs. Beagle, 78 and irascible, takes umbrage at the way her lawyer speaks to her one afternoon in late May. She calls up Blackmore Salmond LLP the very next morning and is escorted to John's office by his team's secretary, Louisa, the next Tuesday. "You handled my grandson Eddie's house purchase," she says, as soon as they've shook hands and he's ushered her into a seat. Eddie Beagle had bought his first house with his wife Jane 3 months earlier, a pretty little Victorian, or at least that's what Jane had told John, when she'd been telling him all about it instead of focusing on the mortgage documents. He'd had to insist she sit down and read them properly. She'd pursed her lips at him and said she'd never been much of a reader, but then done as he'd advised. "Oh, yes," John says. "Are you planning on buying a new house, Mrs. Beagle?" "Call me Kitty," Mrs. Beagle snaps. "I don't hold with any of that formal nonsense. And no, Eddie said you were a good sort, though, and I'm in a bit of a pickle." "Go on," John said, curious as to what sort of troubles an elderly lady might have gotten herself into. "I've been with Parker and Field since I got married, but the blasted little man they've stuck me with tried to tell me what to do with my money after I die, and I'm not having it. I need a new lawyer." "Well, Kitty," John says. "I have to tell you, I've only written a few wills so far, but I'm certainly willing to help. Can you tell me a little bit about what sort of property you have and who you'd like it to go to?" It's not uncommon for people to change their minds about what they want to do with their belongings towards the end. He wonders what whoever she was dealing with at Parker and Field had said that was so bad she decided to change firms. She pulls out a pair of thick reading glasses from her handbag, along with an old banking account book, a sheaf of papers, and a notebook, straightens up in a chair, and proceeds to talk. By the fifth minute, he's interrupted her long enough to ask if she'd mind terribly if he turns on a recording device. 10 minutes later, he's taking frantic shorthand. "So, the lake house in British Columbia, that's with some farmland?" "Yes," she says, and continues down her list. "And I almost forgot," she says, 45 minutes later. "There's 200 acres and a farmhouse in New York. That was my father's. Don't know yet where I want that to go. I'll have to think about it later." John says, "Mrs. Beagle." "It's Kitty," she insists with a scowl. "Beagle's an awful name. Don't think I'm not aware of it." "Kitty," he says. "I'm a first-year associate. I've never handled anything near as complex as your estate. I can absolutely introduce you to one of the partners, though." "Oh, I know Ronald and Douglas well enough," Mrs. Beagle says. "And if she knows Blackmore and Salmond themselves by first name, John has no idea why she's in his office." "Like I said, Eddie said you were a good sort, and you're young enough not to have picked up any bad habits yet." "But I," he says, as she pushes her glasses down her nose to fix him with a gimlet stare. "I knew your grandmother Clarice," she says. "God rest her soul. She'd be very proud of you. Don't worry about the size of the thing. I have an accountant I'll get to call you, and I'll tell Ron to keep an eye on you." Ronald Blackmore, slicked back white hair and pinstriped suit, stops John in the corridor the next afternoon by way of his walking cane. "Heard Kitty Beagle's taken a liking to you. Taves, isn't it?" He winces, more from being spoken to by the managing partner himself than from the walking cane across his knees. "Yes, sir," he manages. "Good, good," Blackmore says. "I don't have to tell you, she's a very big client. And if she likes you, then you'll naturally be her first contact in the firm. Don't hesitate to call upon me or Doug if you get lost in it, or Laura Chang if you've got any tax questions. You know my secretary, Julia? She'll set you up." John hasn't felt this flummoxed in years. "You don't think it should be handled by someone more senior?" he asks. Blackmore gives him a sharp look. "You're doing good work so far," he replies. "And if Kitty Beagle wants you to be her main counsel, then her main counsel you will be." John has not experienced such a sense of impending doom since his first week of law school, when his contract prof had rained fiery condemnation upon 4 people in his row before pointing his finger at John and asking him to outline the facts of the case in question. "With precision, if you please, Mr. Taves." John hadn't done the readings. He never made that mistake again. 4 years in, John's days are measured in 6-minute units, with breaks for coffee and chicken sandwiches. He likes the routine. Mrs. Beagle had apparently raved about his services at golf club meetings and society dinners, so he's accidentally ended up with a solid client base of high-net-worth individuals specializing in asset management and succession planning. Laura Chang has taken him under her wing with respect to tax, since he'll need every bit of experience in that he can grab, and Julie even sometimes deigns to smile at him when he visits Blackmore in his office. He'd always intended to do environmental law, had always liked birdwatching and fishing as a kid, and secretly holds strong opinions about the need to protect the great Canadian wildlife for future generations, but he's not unhappy about where he's ended up. Mrs. Beagle makes an unexpected appointment one gray March afternoon, appears in John's office in pearls and sensible heels. It's the first time he's seen her looking frail. She looks tired when she sits down and refuses anything to drink. Her hands shake when she puts on her glasses and pulls out her notebook. "I don't want Claude to get the farm in New York," she says. "He's planning to sell it to one of those huge American agricorps. It's been farmed by my tenant, Elmer Dougal, for the last 30 years, and I want him to get it." "Is Claude aware he's your current heir for that property, Kitty?" John asks. She shrugs elegantly. "I don't presume to know what that boy does or does not know. All I know is he'll sell my family farm to a corporation over my dead body." John doesn't say it, but that might be the way it happens. "I'll draft the amendment straight away, and you can sign it tomorrow. Mr. Blackmore and I will witness, as usual. But, Kitty, Mr. Dougal isn't a blood relation. That may make it harder to make the inheritance stick if anyone tries to dispute it." "I want you to make sure, Jonathan," she insists. "I will do my very best to protect your assets and get them to where you want them," he replies. "That's not a promise," she points out. "I'm a lawyer," John says. Mrs. Beagle cracks out a smoky, delighted laugh that turns into a horrible hacking cough, and John stays up until 2 a.m, perfecting the amendments to her will, and then sleeps in the office so he can run them by Blackmore first thing. It turns out to be the right course of action, because Mrs. Beagle signs them the very next afternoon. She dies 4 days later, surrounded by half a dozen teary, shattered relatives, and a few dozen others circling like sharks. Blackmore and Salmon attend the funeral with John, all somber in their darkest suits, and are kind or professional enough to stand behind him when he reads the will to Mrs. Beagle's family and representatives of no less than 14 charitable organizations. It turns ugly, children and grandchildren shouting at each other about whether Eleanor deserves the Picasso, long-forgotten family arguments returning to the fore now that money's involved. John sits, impassive, and reasserts the intentions of Mrs. Beagle every time he's called upon to do so. That's a lot. It's not even 2 weeks later that the first of the lawsuits is filed. No surprise to John, Claude is claiming that the New York farm was left to him by his grandfather, and he has the paperwork to prove it. Blackmore Salmon hires Assize Chen Weatherby on retainer to help with the New York jurisdictional clusterfuck, and John is suddenly put into contact with one Mr. Patrick Kane, attorney at law. From what John can tell by his website bio, Mr. Kane is about the same age as John, does a bunch of property work, plus a lot of the firm's pro bono work with women and children. Mr. Kane always seems to be laughing at him a little over the phone when he calls for updates. Nothing unprofessional, but it lurks in the way he says, "And what can I do for you this afternoon, Mr. Taves?" And, "No, I haven't tracked down the original of Mr. Beagle Sr.'s will yet." John doesn't know what that's about. So maybe he's calling a little often, so what? This is by far the biggest disputed estate he's ever handled. Hell, it's one of the biggest Blackmore Salmon has ever handled, and John's taking the lead on it, even though he's only just turned 30. On the suggestion of Blackmore himself, John gets sent down to work out of the offices of Assize Chen Weatherby for a week, just in case somehow having a Canadian lawyer in the building will make magic happen. If Claude's documents turn out to be real and not superseded by a later will of Mr. Beagle Sr., then John's going to have to immerse himself in the insanity of U.S. title insurance, meet up with Mr. Dougal's own lawyer, and start working out what to do next. He can't say he's looking forward to it much. In the meantime, Mr. Kane's amusement has morphed into something more like snark, with a little bit of banter thrown in for good measure, unless John calls him the first thing in the morning, New York time. John admits he might be coming across as a little pedantic sometimes, but that's no reason for Mr. Kane to be calling him the Canadian robot when he calls. On the other hand, John's been calling him Yankee Doodle and harassing him about whether he's gone through the files held in the Esaias Chen Weatherby basement from back when it was Weatherby Morris Stone, yet so. Swings and roundabouts. Mr. Kane, call me Patrick, he says offhand, picks him up at the airport. John hadn't expected it at all, but he's the most attractive human being John has met in person in forever. Objectively, he's kind of a wreck. Not that tall, ugly suit and frankly disturbing tie, hair that's both too long and balding at the temples. But holy Christ, his smile. John really, really hopes he can keep it together. He's got work to do. John spends a week in Buffalo, half of it on the phone to other clients back at home. By the end of it, Patrick has painstakingly explained New York land law to him, twice. That shit is fucking unnecessarily complicated, okay? And it's been a long time since law school. Hooked him up with a really helpful woman at the insurance company, just in case, and managed to find, deep in a file box, a piece of paper which completely shuts out Claude's claim on the farm. John hasn't crushed on anyone's brain this hard since third-year law school, where he developed a very uncomfortable hard-on for the dignified professor who'd taken him for advanced public law. Patrick's clearly the kind of lawyer who gets invested in the stories of his clients. When he's not walking John through the perils of title to land in the state of New York, he's buried in restraining orders for domestic violence and criminal defense work for young, stupid dudes who punched someone who didn't want to be punched at the time. He's not that interested in land law, but he's also very clearly the firm's best associate, a fraction of a hair away from being offered partnership even though he's even younger than John is. John spends most of his days in the firm's library, though they do let him borrow an empty meeting room. Except, that is, for the Thursday afternoon, which John spends on a tractor being driven around the farm's boundaries by Elmer Dougal himself. It's fucking appalling to think of the organic pumpkin fields being ripped up and replaced by a series of pig barns. His last day in New York, Patrick comes into the library as John's beginning to pack up all his shit at 7 p.m. John doesn't know how it starts, but they end up having a terrible fight, where Patrick accuses him of not even caring about the outcome of all their hard work. John tries really hard to be polite and not let his emotions get the best of him, but it's been a stressful week on top of a stressful month, and he ends up hissing back at Patrick. It's not my fucking job to care about any of the heirs. I care about getting it right. I care about doing the best for my client that I can. I care about upholding the rule of the law. But I work for the estate, Patrick, and my client is dead. No matter where my personal sympathies might lie, I have to keep that in mind. Patrick stares at him. You do care, he says, and it sounds like it's a revelation. John sighs. She was nice to me, okay? She tried to give me wine for Christmas once. I couldn't accept it, of course, but this is the largest estate I've ever handled, and it's a big deal for me. Patrick smiles fiercely. Well, we'll just have to make sure her assets go where she wanted them, then, he says. John stares at him. Patrick's staring back, as if John's shitfit about professionalism has both genuinely impressed him and turned him the fuck on. They end up exchanging rough, frantic handjobs in the second-floor disability access bathroom. John feels really bad about it, because people might need that space, so he tries to get it over fast, even though he wants to maybe touch Patrick all over and or fuck his face. After that, Patrick takes him out to sushi for dinner, and John tells him the whole sordid story of Mrs. Beagle and her terrible relatives fighting over her estate like vultures. It's understandable, Patrick says. What is? Asks John. People fighting over wills. How? John asks, genuinely confused. He's always been confused by this. I just don't understand why people can't just respect the wishes of the deceased. Yeah, Patrick says, true. But, like, it's the last way you can say you love someone, by giving them what you leave behind when you go. I don't think it's about love, John says. Maybe not necessarily, Patrick argues, but that's what people take it as. The last great I love you, sweetheart, or the last great fuck you. John presses his lips together. He can't really think of a good retort. Don't worry about the bill, Patrick says when they're done. I'll get it. You mean, expense it and charge it to Blackmore Salmon, John says, and Patrick smirks at him. Don't be such a cynic, Patrick says. I would never. There's a weird moment where John thinks Patrick's maybe going to invite him home. John would go in a fucking shot, but it passes. They end up shaking hands outside the restaurant before John heads back in a taxi to his hotel room alone. John goes back to Winnipeg and settles back into his office. He falls into a pattern of emailing Patrick about once a week, at first demands for updates, but it turns into mostly arguing with each other about whether justice is blind or whether you can come to equity without clean hands. A few months later, he goes to Toronto for a tax conference along with Laura Chang. The hot topic of debate is the possible reintroduction of gift duty, and he spends a solid 5 hours in a bar catching up with old friends from law school and discussing the possible effect it would have on estate planning, and stays there for the weekend. Patrick drives up from Buffalo for the Saturday, and they hang out, wandering around downtown Toronto and taking shitty tourist photos. It wouldn't be a conversation with Patrick if they didn't end up fighting, and so it is that John finds himself screaming at Patrick about giving legal aid to abusive husbands while Patrick screams back about fairness and justice having to be for everyone, not just for the worthy or the good. They're in the street at the time, it's dusk, a warm summer evening, and people are edging around them, staring. Fuck you, John, Patrick shouts. The system shouldn't just be for the benefit of clients like yours. What the fuck is that supposed to mean? John asks. You know what I'm saying, Patrick retorts. You fucking have no idea what it's like doing criminal defense work for people who owe hundreds of dollars in fines they can't pay. It's part of the social contract that people have access to justice. Oh, fuck you and your socialist bullshit, man, John says, and they're off again, barely looking where they're going because they're way too busy exchanging barbs. They end up grabbing dinner at a seedy kebab joint 3 blocks from John's hotel, and then heading to a sports bar that's got the Leafs game up on the screens. Patrick gets really into it, heckling everyone and coming up with some pretty impressive examples of why the Leafs suck so bad. The weird thing is, they're in fucking Toronto, and the locals are just nodding along, weary, like they've said all this shit before time and time again, and it's kind of nice for them not to have to make the effort this time around. John thinks of inviting Patrick up for the night, but they've never spoken about the bathroom handjob thing, and it had been kind of shitty anyway, and he really likes Patrick as a friend, so he doesn't. He ends up being pretty glad about it. Patrick steps him through the most ridiculous 14-part handshake before he wanders out of John's hotel lobby, and that doesn't seem like evidence that Patrick wants John's body or anything. 8 months after John had gone to New York, he's got to go back. Claude is determined to go to court, and while Patrick's obviously going to be the one talking, John wants to be there. The Beagle estate is still by far his largest file, and this is but one more step on his carefully laid out plans to get the whole thing settled and out of his hair for good. He explains this to Patrick, who laughs at him and says, A, John's losing his hair at a staggering rate anyway, so he'd better hurry up, and B, he knew John just wanted to come see him in court. Both of these things are true, so John just sucks it up and goes back to emailing Louisa about the Murphy property. Patrick in court is fucking electric. John had known he was good, had maybe spent some quality time at home stalking him on LinkedIn and Facebook, had known there had to be more to the guy than just shitty opinions about tort reform. But this is incredible. He's clearly barely even exerting himself. The judge just rolls over, throws out the entire case for lack of merit, which is proof that there is justice in the world. And they're out of the courtroom by lunchtime. If that's Patrick in court, in an area of law he feels no passion for in a comparatively easy case, John kind of desperately wants to know what he can do when he needs to work hard for it. Fuck yeah, I'm awesome, Patrick says, when John suggests they go grab something to eat before Patrick has to go back to the office. Shut the fuck up, John says, but his voice clearly lacks conviction. And Patrick just grins at him, not even trying to hide that he's pleased. That's the end of it then? Patrick asks over noodles. Are you kidding me? John answers. Now it's going to drag on for years. No, I mean, you're done with New York, Patrick says. Well, yeah, John says. But, like I said, I've still got to track down that family case I told you about. I still don't believe you about the goat, Patrick says. You've been practicing for how many years, and you don't believe me about the goat? John retorts.
and Patrick accepts the point by screwing up his face and shrugging. Patrick responds to the family case by spamming John with 16 pictures of goats, all looking contented. Some of them are even chewing on laundry. It's still his work email, though, so John forwards the latest one to his home address and then emails Patrick back from there, which gets him Patrick's personal email in response. It ramps up into a steady stream of exchanges, mostly involving hilarious/shitty unreported cases from every English-speaking jurisdiction they can find, cat pictures, and an in-joke involving a horse macro. John's pretty confident they're flirting. Like, Patrick had responded to a particularly juicy divorce case with, "You wouldn't do anything like that, would you, Mr. Taves?" Winky smile. And that seems to point towards sex feelings. He's single, has an easy fuck buddy thing going with a conveyancing lawyer he knows from another firm, and he's pretty sure Patrick mostly is too, apart from short-term things he has with a bunch of people he refers to in his emails by names like Red Cat and Hipster Boy. It's pretty sad how much casual cruelty about other people turns John on, really. The next time he's in Toronto, handling some cross-province advisory work with Blackmore himself, Laura Chang on point, and Salmon in the Wings with the firm's librarian and team of law clerks at the ready, he convinces Patrick to use one of his precious, precious U.S. vacation days so they can hang out when John's done with meetings at lunchtime.
They have dinner that night in a ludicrously fancy restaurant, all white linen napkins and unobtrusive waitstaff who keep their wine glasses topped up and bring them amuse-bouches in between courses. Patrick's in fine form, keeping John entertained with tales of restraining orders and child defendants, while John responds by outlining the details of an epic family feud he'd heard of through the grapevine. After dessert, they split the bill and head to this bar that John heard of from one of his old law school buddies who's now working in Toronto. It's entirely populated with young professionals arguing about ethics violations and securities law over glasses of red wine and bread platters. Everybody's wearing a suit, although the drunker ones have loosened their ties, and some of the women are walking very carefully between bar and booth in their 4-inch work heels. Patrick looks around the place, obviously amused by the wood paneling, definitely inauthentic considering they're in a basement of a high-rise, and the mixed-matched chandeliers hanging over every booth, dimmed down to private conversation level and barely twinkling in the gloom. He heads straight over to the bar, catches the eye of the preppy-looking bartender, young, hip, tattooed. John was young once. And begins by ordering what turns out to be about the first of many overpriced cocktails. John goes along with this because law school taught him that he doesn't like aniseed or the flavor blue much, and that sugar and alcohol should only be mixed for so long, but he's pretty much good with everything else. Also, it's fun to watch Patrick make emphatic hand gestures as he tries to explain how John's next cocktail should taste like the moon feels. John's gonna have to leave a massive tip, but that's okay, he can afford it. They end up in a booth with a bunch of women who do commercial and local government work, talking about comparative land law. Patrick argues vehemently and loudly in favor of the U.S. system, which is the stupidest thing John's heard in years, but whatever, he still wants to fuck Patrick so bad it's painful. John interrupts Patrick in the middle of a speech about medieval land tenure and the great Anglo-American tradition to insist that Torrance is the greatest. Everybody else at the table is Canadian, so he gets a lot of loud agreement, which Patrick shoots aside with a shake of his head and a wave of his hands. "You're so fucking wrong, it hurts me," Patrick says, grinning at him, and then he starts in on the legal Latin. That's dirty pool right there. John flees the table to get them both another drink. The bartender takes pity on him and throws together a couple of cocktails for him before serving the much hotter group of young blonde associates, and he gets back to the table just in time to hear Patrick break out with some quote in French about continental land law before derailing himself into the beginning of an argument about the superiority of adversarial court systems. Nobody was even arguing that point, but that fucking does it anyway. John loses it, slams back his cocktail, orange, way too sweet, slams back Patrick's, murky green, olive-y, kind of gross, and throws every bill in his wallet on the table before hustling Patrick outside. Patrick doesn't try to stop him, just waves at the women and smirks at the bartender. "You realize the bathrooms were right there, man," Patrick says, laughing at John like the sight of him broken with desire is the funniest fucking thing he's seen in years. "You dickbag," John shoots back. "Are you in or not?" Patrick's face changes, and he's not laughing when he says, "I'm so fucking in." They go back to John's hotel and fuck in positions that John hasn't even tried since he was a lot younger and a lot more flexible. It's amazing, but John hates almost everything in the entire world when his alarm goes off at 6 a.m. He's got an 8 a.m. meeting where he's going to have to talk intelligently about possible trust structures, and it's time to start in on the coffee. He wakes up Patrick before he has to go by dropping a packet of ibuprofen on his head. Patrick cracks his eyes open as John's putting on his tie, grins at him, and starts complaining. My fucking head, man. Oh, God. John has no fucking sympathy. Patrick just has to get back to Buffalo by lunchtime, and that's super easy. He doesn't even have a client meeting this afternoon. They do the long-distance thing for a while, seeing each other every 6 weeks or so. It's both terrible and wonderful. Wonderful because it's the best relationship John's had in his life. And terrible because he wants to see Patrick so much more often than they manage. But at the same time, he's not sure how to go about doing that, or whether it would ruin things. Blackmore comes to see him after 10 months of John being randomly and entirely unavailable one weekend in six. "You've been going to Toronto a lot, John," he says. "Yes," John replies, hoping like hell he's not in trouble for it. "Relax," Blackmore laughs. "I'm not about to fire you over it." John's shoulders drop. Good. "You remember my old friend Tom Gardner at Wilcox, Steele, Wagner, McCulkey? Does your sort of work for some of the oldest families in Toronto?" Yes, John says, remembering who he's talking to. He's looking for someone to come in and begin to take over some of his clients. Nobody at Wilcox Steele is particularly interested or has enough of an aptitude for it, and he remembered your work on the Mandelbrot Griswold file. "What?" John asks. "Don't play stupid, son," Blackmore says. "You'll make partner here if you stick around another couple years, but I suspect you've got competing interests." "I don't know what to say," John says. "Look, at this stage, all you have to do is give him a call. Find out if it's something you'll be interested in. That's it." "But I've worked in Winnipeg my entire career," John argues. "And all of my family..." Blackmore shrugs. "It'd be a big decision, for sure. I'll tell Tom you're thinking about it." Thanks, John says, for want of anything better, when Blackmore stands to leave. Blackmore's just out the door when he turns back. "John... people have done more stupid things for love." John is a lawyer, and knows to the marrow of his bones that this is so, but still, what the fuck was that? He brings it up with Patrick the next time they see each other, a couple of weeks later. He's in discussions with Tom Gardner, talking about having a formal interview in a month or so, and then spending the 6 months after that getting qualified in Ontario and clearing up his Winnipeg files. "Are you serious?" Patrick demands. "Yes," John says. He really hopes this hasn't been a terrible fucking idea. "Holy shit," Patrick replies. "Like, really?" "I'm pretty sure I have, in fact, been talking to Tom Gardner about transferring to Toronto, yes." Patrick glares at him. "Now isn't the time for sarcasm, man." "That's bullshit. It's always time for sarcasm, in John's opinion, and Patrick normally shares that belief. It's one of the more awesome things they have in common. "I don't have to, like, it's early days. I just wanted to know if, I mean, I could maybe be around a little more if you wanted," John says. This emotional shit is hard work. "That'd be fucking excellent," Patrick says. And so now he sounds enthusiastic. "I'd love that. I mean, like I said, it's early days and nothing's... Nothing's definite yet," Patrick interjects. "It takes time and effort to change jobs. You have a lot of clients in Winnipeg and no idea whether the Toronto clients will want to change over. It's a big decision. Stop looking at me like that. I went to Harvard, you know. I know how contingency planning goes." "You did," John agrees amiably and kisses him. His mom's pretty upset that he's moving all the way to Ontario. She's met Patrick a few times now, but she still wants to tell him that this is a huge decision to be making. Which, he does know that already. "Leave him alone," his dad says eventually. "He's made up his mind." "And it's only a 2-hour flight," John adds. "I should know." The formal interview had gone brilliantly. One of the other partners had even told John that his will drafting was beautiful in its clarity of intent and lack of ambiguity, which isn't something you hear every day. At this point, he's clearing up the last of his files for whoever's taking them over. Most of his clients, thank God, are staying with Blackmore Salmond, but nevertheless, it's making for a lot of long nights as he explains the intricacies of various trusts and property arrangements to a bunch of his colleagues. The condo he gets in Toronto is about half the size of the place he had in Winnipeg, but the views are way better, and Patrick drives up late every second Friday and stays until 4 a.m. Monday morning, so. The other weekends, John drives to Buffalo, which is growing on him steadily. Work at Wilcox Steel is interesting, if stressful. It's an old firm, with client families who've stuck around for a century or more, and John's very definitely the new kid on the block in the field of looking after the interests of Toronto's favored wealthy few. The clients Tom Gardner's introducing him to seem to feel like they're in safe hands with him, though. After a year of swapping international borders every weekend, John's getting tired of it. Not tired of Patrick, but tired of the back and forth of it, tired of having to cancel when things come up at work, and of feeling bad when he has to leave Patrick to watch hockey on cable while he writes agreements for other couples. He thinks Patrick's tired of the same things. He's been looking exhausted lately, and John knows some of the family law stuff he's working on is really hard to deal with sometimes, but he doesn't know how to bring it up. In the end, he doesn't have to. They end up having a screaming match about whether the Sabres or the Habs suck more one Saturday morning in Buffalo while clearing up breakfast, and John shouts at him, "What the fuck's your problem anyway?" "Fuck you," Patrick screams back. "Canadian law is fucking bizarre, okay?" "And what?" "What?" John says dumbly. Patrick replies and looks sheepish. "Why the fuck are you boning up on Canadian law?" Patrick repeats. Johnny puts down the marmalade. "Seriously, Patrick." "Seriously, John," Patrick sneers back and then deflates. "I've been looking into emigrating." "Oh my God," John replies. "Really?" "I just said so," Patrick says. "There's this family law practice near your office, Keith and Seabrook, that I've dealt with a few times, cross-border custody agreements, that kind of thing. They're looking for someone who has a New York license to join them, get some in-house expertise, but I'd have to be called to the bar in Ontario, too." "Wow," John says. Patrick gives him kind of a funny look. John's feeling kind of weird and must look it or something. "Is that all you're gonna say?" "Oh my God, Patrick," John says. His face hurts from smiling, and Patrick's grinning back at him. "Don't hurt yourself with feelings or whatever," Patrick says. "Shut the fuck up," John replies. "I'll have as many feelings as I like, and screw you." "You're okay with the idea?" Patrick asks. "Shit, yes," John says, faintly, and then has to sit back down so he can think about it and smile some more. They spend the rest of the weekend batting comparative law back and forth. Patrick's already got a pretty clear idea of how land law works because John's ranted to him about it often enough, and John helps him clear some of his other queries in what turns out to be 6 folders worth of study material and bar requirements. John drives home that Monday morning in something of a daze, having promised he'd start looking for houses for them to view. They agree to rent for a while, with an eye to buying in a year or two if things are still working well. John also plans to draft a prenup. They both have assets to protect, but he'll wait a while before he springs that on Patrick. They get a dog. His name is Denning. The end.